And we're back with KVRX HD2. It is April 3rd, 2018. You're listening to Not Fake News on KVRX HD2 at Austin. I'm your host, Anurag Singh. With me, as always, is Wes Dodson. Wes, is your mic on? Let's check.
Yeah.
I think it is, yeah.
Alrighty.
One of them is. And so we have a lot of stories to talk about this week. I mean, of course, the president this Sunday announced the death of DACA. And today suggested he wanted to use the military to guard his border wall. So we're going to discuss who's responsible for DACA, the death of DACA, and, you know, what does it mean for the U.S. relations with Mexico? Because I think that's important. And then, of course, Trump also launched attacks on Amazon. And so we'll ask if those are politically motivated. They almost certainly are. And then, he also fired the VA secretary, or there's some miscommunication about whether he got fired or he resigned. So we'll talk about that. And towards the end, I did want to address the Israel-Palestine conflict, because, of course, over the weekend, Israel opened fire on protesters in Gaza. So we'll assess that towards the end. But, so let's just dive into it. DACA, is it a thing that is going to be existing? I mean, he announced the death of it this Sunday. I mean, he had this sort of unhinged tweet storm where he was just sort of talking about how we're gonna get rid of it. So what are your thoughts initially?
Yeah, so this seems to be in direct response to the caravan, so to speak, that's moving up from South America towards the United States. Not even clear if most or all or even some of those are going to successfully cross the border. I should say that these are people that are escaping war in Honduras, war and conflict in Honduras, and are making their way up towards Mexico. Many of them are stopping in kind of Mexico and surrounding areas, and you know, Trump seems to think that these potential illegal immigrants pose a dire national security threat, and so was reacting rather rashly, as he is wont to.
Yeah.
to that imagery. And basically the kind of political fallout that we've seen here is he's blaming the Democrats for this. Not entirely surprising, but his real kind of, I think, if we're going to ascribe some kind of hidden motive, is to really leverage Congress, use DACA, as he's tried to do in the past, to leverage Congress for funding for this border wall. We've seen a policy proposal come out that's got both limits on, and this is from the White House, limits on legal immigration, kind of curtailing the program there, as well as funding for that border wall. As you've said, he made some gesture towards the increasing militarization of the border wall. I saw some piece that said it was the National Guard that he had proposed.
Yeah, so today I think he talked about how he wanted to use the military to wants to get the military, not just the National Guard, but the military. He talked to Mattis, he talked to the Secretary Mattis and Paul Ryan, and he wanted to put military people on the border. But I think your reading is correct. But so we should mention, I mean, this tweet storm on Sunday was, they talked about the caravans, they talked about the DACA deal and the need for the wall, right? But I think the reason for his sort of shift in terms of immigration, like over the weekend, runs a bit deeper than just he saw the caravan story on Fox News, which is what probably what happened, because the caravan story was run on Fox News.
Right, yeah.
I think it's because you look at this budget deal he signed where he got almost nothing for his border wall.
Yeah,
right?
$1.6 billion for increased border security and studies in border security. So
yeah, in fact,
nothing substantive.
Of that billion, only $641 million is actually used for the fencing. And you can really only build the fence so far in San Diego on this sort of, where a barrier already exists there.
Right.
So it's just improving a barrier. So he obviously was unhappy about that. He said he would never sign a deal like that again. And And then over the weekend, he goes to Mar-a-Lago, right, with with his family, and then also this aide, Stephen Miller, who's part of Steve Bannon's racist ilk, who is pretty incompetent. I don't know why he's one of the senior aides in Trump's administration, but that's that aside. I mean, Stephen Miller is a proponent of these anti-immigration policies, and he spends the weekend with, you know, a lot of these Fox News commentators like Sean Hannity and Jeanine Pirro, who are these the most loony of the Fox News sort of commentators in terms of immigration. And then he comes back on Sunday and he says we need to start building these caravans and, you know, killing DACA and stuff like that. And the remarkable thing here is that when you look at what conservatives say about how the media is, you know, working hand in hand with the Democratic elite, right? Here you have a prime example of Donald Trump going around, going to the Mar-a-Lago on the taxpayer's dollar, and then talking to the conservative media and getting his talking points from them. Mm-hmm. And then you look at, you know, over the weekend also, Sinclair Media. There was this big story about Sinclair, which is this kind of this local TV kind of giant that is very associated with conservative media, going around and parroting the Trump line about fake news and in the press, right?
Right, yeah. And one thing that we should make clear here is that as Trump kind of bloviates about DACA and the lack thereof, rather, you know, the federal judge in California temporarily blocked the Trump administration decision to end DACA.
Yeah.
And so it
Was that lifted? Is that still in place?
No, it's still in place. So, you know, DACA as of right now is running not as normal, but is not, you know, completely dead if we were to mm-hmm. use Trump's parlance.
I mean, if you look at the situation, right, like it's he keeps blaming DACA. For this, mm-hmm. for the Democrats for ending DACA. The Democrats
right.
came up to Trump several times and gave him the deal on DACA. Let's be clear, he was the one that shut it down. So, I mean, his claim that Democrats are the reason DACA is dead is completely false. It's him who's the one who jeopardized it in the first place and put it on the table in terms of negotiation.
Yeah.
And the irony here is that, you know, in terms of if he's so upset about the fact that he got, like, you know, scraps for his border wall, he could have easily come to the table with the Democrats and negotiated a better deal if he had actually given something to the Democrats in regards to DACA. Instead, he wants to scrap DACA and then cut legal immigration. And yeah, of course, he's not going to get anything for the wall. So ironically, his whole he claims he's a negotiator, but he clearly just doesn't know how to negotiate because he couldn't even get his wall built.
Yeah, I mean, I think drawing a distinction between Trump's position and the Republican Party's position is a pretty helpful clarification. You know, in those funding negotiations, to the extent that Trump had a role, it was probably, you know, subordinate to that of the GOP, you know, congressmen and senators that were doing the real kind of meat of the discussion. And they really don't seem to be behind this wall as a concept. I think something we've talked about on the show in the past is the idea that, you know, there are true immigration hawks in
yeah.
Congress, and you know, they realize that this wall won't even, you know, achieve the stated goal
yeah.
of
it's not going to do. It's a very ridiculous idea.
Right.
The idea that's going to curb. I mean, first of all, immigration is already down in
yeah,
terms of Mexico.
We've got net X flow, so net emigration with an E out towards Mexico.
And it
so,
won't stop the illegal immigration problem because it's the visa thing. It's
right.
People are flying over and staying. It's not people flowing through the Mexican border, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and so a lot of the immigration hawks in Congress didn't support the wall because they didn't think it would accomplish the stated goals. And then another reason is that, you know, Republicans actually really aren't all that hawkish as a voting bloc, aren't all that hawkish on immigration is really the kind of Trump base. And so the moderate Republicans that we think about are really turned off by this issue. And so a lot of, you know, Republicans that are looking to the 2018 midterms are hedging on this issue. And
yeah.
so I don't think we're going to see a lot of movement in terms of of where the GOP congressmen and senators.
I mean, yeah, you make a, on this. You make a good point that it was really the work of the GOP trying to negotiate this budget. But my point was about how, I mean, we've seen presidents in the past play a big role in the budget negotiation process.
Yeah, no, of course.
And I mean, if Donald Trump really wanted his wall to be built, I was just saying that there are several things he could have done during the negotiation process to try to get his way. I mean, he has the upper hand. He has all the cards in his hand because he has the Republicans in the House and the Senate. So he could have, I mean, I don't know. It's just clear that this whole border wall thing is not materializing. And let's be clear, remember, Mexico was supposed to pay for the wall, which was never supposed to happen, but that was one of his lines. And now he's suggesting using the military to go and put it near this wall. I mean, it's ridiculous. And another thing is that all of his criticisms of immigration seem to be devoid of fact. I mean, he thinks that the migrants that are coming in through the caravan system, first of all, it's one caravan, and last we heard of it, it was in Mexico, like in some sports state, like near a sports stadium. So the idea that it's an imminent threat to national security is pretty scary.
It's, I mean, to the extent that it might reach the United States, I've seen numbers saying it's about 2 months out if it moves at current pace, and a lot of observers are saying that people are stopping along the way and settling down.
And the idea that once they get to the border, they'll be able to come inside.
No, yeah,
probably not even going to happen.
The U.S. border is actually rather secure. The ways of getting across it tend to be through what we would kind of think as legally illegal measures. So you talked about the kind of overstaying visas. Anything in that realm tends to be one of the primary ways that people get across. Of course, illegal immigration across the southern border is a real thing. I mean, it does exist.
The kinds of things that he, for example, the idea that the migrants can get asylum through DACA, which is not making any sense.
The point should be reiterated over and over that the individuals in this caravan would be like not even close to eligible for the DACA benefits. DACA is specifically for the children of illegal immigrants born in the U.S. And so there's just no conceivable way that this is a way that they're going to get into the system. And one thing that we should note is that even in talks of ending DACA, there is something on the order of 11 million illegal immigrants as an estimate in the United States. And so we don't have the funding to deport all of those. That is just a statement of fact. Regardless of opinion,
it's not going to happen.
Right. Regardless of opinion about what whether you actually want to or not, we can't as a logistic issue. And so there must be some prioritization of the deportation status of illegal immigrants, just in the terms of logistics. ICE cannot deport all of them. They have to pick and choose their battles. And so I think one thing that we're going to want to look out for is whether Trump does a more aggressive stance on DACA than his even current stance is going and saying we're going to prioritize DACA deportation. That would be something that I think would bring him incredible political backlash.
And it would also be, I mean, in terms of just morally, I mean, I think it's ludicrous that you would prioritize. I mean, DACA is the idea that DACA, that's the program for the best of the best in terms of,
right, of course,
the people.
And Trump has shown, no reticence to kind of attack that program. And I wouldn't expect him to show any particular qualms about attacking the people in the program as far as deportation goes in a kind of half-wit effort to get the funding for his wall. It would be a shame, and the people in this program are just incredible boons to the U.S. economy. And, I think what we're going to see at the end of this is that we're going to get some movement in terms of where the Democrats stand.
Yeah.
If I were to have a kind of prediction, my guess is they give some token funding so that Trump can start funding on his wall in exchange for a DACA program. The president for all of his bluster, is not known for keeping his promises and not known for staying in a particular position for very long. So I expect to see some thawing in his.
Well, I don't even know. I don't know what the situation is. I mean, on the one hand, you have the Donald Trump, who is, I mean, he changes his positions like almost every single weekend.
Right.
And so he may just decide not to do anything on this. But if he legitimately threatens to start deporting people in DACA, I mean, on the other hand, we have the Democrats in the House and the Senate, who, first of all, they don't really have much power, but they're pretty spineless as it is, right? I mean, they came to the table saying, we're not going to budge on DACA. And then they said, yeah, we'll just let it not happen. So I don't know if they might cede the control. I mean, if Trump threatens to deport people under DACA, will the Democrats take it as, you know, calling the bluff, or will they actually start giving money for the border wall? I think that if he tried to even start that process of deporting people under the DACA program, I mean, the political backlash would be far, not just in Democratic places. I mean, here in Texas, we have people who are DACA people under the DACA program who have been here for, you know, they're all their life. I mean, it's the idea that you're going to take those people and then put them somewhere. Where are you even going to deport these people? I don't even know. It's
right.
Crazy.
Yeah, and even the current measure that he's proposing, the kind of increased militarization of the southern border, is something that Texans and those along it will just kind of gnash their teeth at. We've seen increased militarization before. It results in economic loss for the communities on the kind of surrounding areas of the border. Texans in that area really do not like federal agents running amok on their land.
And that would require the whole thing about eminent domain, about
yes.
the government would have to take the private lands. And I imagine that doesn't sit well with a lot of the people who are there.
It doesn't. And the economies of these towns and rural areas are really built on the pillar of industrious, though legally ambiguous, you know, workers, and so increased federal presence in those areas is a kind of is a danger to both the economies and the kind of fabrics of those communities. And Texans really do kind of writhe under that. We have seen increasing calls from the southern areas of Texas against this border wall, and some of that, you know, comes from the more libertarian, less kind of doctrinal Republican areas. But for the most part, the people that are informed about the issue in the southern kind of areas of Texas really, really do not like Trump's proposal.
I mean, it seems like this whole anti-immigration sort of stance, like I said before, it is devoid of fact. I mean, you look at these, not just this, the DACA program and the larger point about the wall, but other points in this, you know, talking points in this agenda, like the whole idea of catch and release. They talk about catch and release as being used on the border. That doesn't exist. That's not even a thing. That's just a lie. And then you look at, for example, the idea that, you know, even if we're just talking about, you know, refugees and asylum seekers, the idea that they're so pernicious to the economy that they destroy it, or they suck away American jobs. I mean, the research on that is at best, it's iffy. You know, conservatively, it's read as sort of the jury's out on that one.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the legal immigration question becomes a bit more difficult. By and large, I haven't seen anything compelling that suggests that legal immigration, we tend to import people on work visas when it comes to legal immigration, and so they have, you know, it's the industry demanding a worker with the skills not supplied by the American job economy, and so it's not a replacement as much as it is an additional added worker in our GDP. And then the illegal immigration argument, there's some, you know, a potential wage depression in the area of low skill workers without a high school degree, which represents just a very small part of our economy.
And it just the idea that even the legal immigration system is some sort of very lax system that lets a lot of people come in. That is, I mean, the work visa program and getting in people, like relatives, through the work visa program is still, it is also, you know, obstacles within obstacles.
It's an incredibly arduous process.
And when you talk about illegal immigrants who are here trying to get a path to citizenship, I mean, the DACA program is one of the ways to get a path to citizenship, but you see people 20 to 30 years they're waiting for that sort of
thing. Yeah, and DACA, you know, is this kind of tenuous citizenship, if you will, because it's executive or because it's under the purview of the executive. Is subject, as we've seen with Trump's stance, to the whims of the president, and something that the Congress really needs to take a legislative approach to. But one thing that we should note is that the notion that being tougher on illegal immigrants in terms of sentencing, deporting, all of those is going to lead to lower crime rates really doesn't seem to be the case. One thing that we as a kind of Western democracy have realized is that the punishment fitting the crime is something that actually lowers crime rates. So having gradations of penalties for crimes really does act as a kind of stopgap measure for violent crime. And so when these folks aren't in the legal system and they face deportation for being pulled over for a broken taillight and deportation for heinous violent crimes, there is no real kind
distinction.
Of distinction. And so a lot of the times what we're seeing in the communities of those who are violent in the kind of illegal immigrant terms is they tend to be quite violent. They tend to be, you know, MS-13.
Of course.
And that's,
I mean, if you're going to get pulled over and you know that this is the end, like you're going to be, because you're being pulled over, you're going to get deported. You're going to get, you know, you're going to fight back.
I mean, yeah, and it's not even, and like I said, you know, we don't want to conflate that. Most the illegal immigrant community commits far fewer crimes on average, but those who are violent tend to be more violent. And that's partly because there's that lack of gradation, because we don't have these people incorporated into the justice system, and we can't put fitting punishment to fitting crimes. It is, you know, you get busted with, you know, a beer or, you know, open canister, deported. You know, there's no gradation, and so there's no real reason to stop at low-level crime, and so we tend to see these organizations proceed all the way to violent crime.
And you, I mean, one of the things that comes to mind is the whole idea of the sanctuary city, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this is one of the Trump talking points. The sanctuary city is so terrible and it's horrendous or whatever. And you look at the sanctuary cities in California. I mean, one of the reasons that the whole point of the sanctuary city is that if you have someone who is an illegal immigrant, you want them to cooperate with the police.
Yes.
If there's some sort of crime in their community. Like, so for example, you know, they'll have a lot of witnesses come forward who are illegal immigrants who say, yeah, I saw this crime. And then that helps the police department. So this is, I mean, the idea that the irony here is that you're impeding local law enforcement's ability to enforce crime by going after the illegal immigrants who are just, the only reason they're illegal immigrants is because they're stuck in this sort of citizenship debacle. And by the way, you know, Republicans used to talk about that, right? They used to talk about the path to citizenship. And I think what the thing with the horrible thing about, the unfortunate thing about DACA is that President Obama had to go use the executive sort of thing because the Republicans at that time didn't want to negotiate. They didn't want to appear on the side of Obama. So, I mean, when you look at that, around that time, a lot of the Republicans were saying DACA is horrible, it's terrible. And now when they have one of their guys in the office and who's planning to get rid of it, they're like, okay, well, we were actually not that opposed to DACA. We just said that because it was for rhetoric.
Yeah, and let's remember that the most tried and true method for reducing illegal immigration is to actually have better economies in the areas that, you know, send illegal immigrants our way. And so that has proven true. Mexico's economy is doing far better than it was in the kind of 1980s, 1990s when we saw spikes in immigration to the United States. And so one thing that seems discongruous or incongruous with the kind of notion that we're trying to stop the flow of illegal immigration is Trump's, you know, very belligerent rhetoric towards South America and towards, you know, trade relationships with those countries.
Yeah.
And so I just think that you know, it's a good idea to reiterate here the notion of open borders, the notion of, you know, a lot of people have varying opinions on it, but I come from the kind of position of if you're in the country and you don't have a communicable disease or a violent criminal record, we should incorporate you into the legal system, and that doesn't necessarily mean citizenship. That doesn't necessarily mean that they, you know, receive welfare benefits, and you know that's all policy issues that can be hammered out. But in terms of incorporating people into the legal, you know, justice system, it's a real travesty that we've got these folks who are constantly living in fear of being deported and aren't able to really add all that they could to the economy because of that. And so DACA was a step in the right direction, obviously, and we need to go further. And, you know, with President Trump in the White House, I really don't see a way forward on that currently.
Yeah, I guess, there's a lot of talk about that, but I want to move on to the other battle he's picking, which is with Amazon. This is also with China as well, but, I mean, Amazon was the one that he started attacking, and that actually had an effect on the stock market. If you look at, I think the Dow went down more than 600 points at various moments on Monday afternoon. Mm-hmm. Asian stocks fell for a second day. And then Apple, Alphabet, Microsoft, they all closed down on Monday because the reason is because, you know, I think Amazon stock went down by 5% because Trump over the weekend, or I think it was over this past week, has been tweeting about how Amazon is, you know, destroying the U.S. post office and how we need to go after them and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So he has been attacking Amazon over the medium that he uses. So.
Yeah, well, let me just kind of say that if I never get a letter from the USPS again, I will be a happier man than I was. Amazon, look, I mean, it fits partly. It's a personal attack. You know, Jeff Bezos is a kind of avid supporter of the free press and of the Washington Post. He's a kind of heavy donor to them, part of the reason that they're able to do such great journalism that they do. And so part of it's personal.
It is almost 100% political. The whole idea, like you mentioned, the Washington Post is run. I mean, he keeps calling it the Amazon Washington Post, which, I mean, it's clearly that, like, Jeff Bezos, he has this sort of, this administration is all about personal relationships. And if he doesn't like the guy, you know, Jeff Bezos, then he's going to attack the company.
Yeah. And look, the president attacking private companies is something that we've seen before with this president, but something that really we have resisted as a nation. You know, the Republican and kind of free market idea of not picking winners and losers doesn't just extend to the kind of structures of government. It really does extend as well to the way that government interacts with all businesses. And so when Donald Trump is getting out there and hammering these folks for their business practices, which are perfectly fair, perfectly legal, we're getting into the territory where President Trump is picking market winners and losers based on personal whim, and that's something that I think is really dangerous. And we should mention that, you know, the idea that Donald Trump is worried about the U.S. post office, like, doesn't make any sense. Yeah. I mean, the conservatives have decried the wasteful government spending in that area for, like, literally since it got off the ground. I think Paul Revere rode on a lame horse, I imagine, you know, in the kind of postal system there. And so, yeah, it's this idea that big is bad, and big companies that practice new, you know, AI technology and anything that he perceives as leading to job loss, which is not true. Amazon is a net creator of jobs. It's simply just nonsense that they destroy jobs in America on net. Of course, there are, you know, retail marketing and industries that are affected by what Amazon does, but the reason that Amazon is able to do what it does is because it's got great people working behind it. It's got a very efficient method. Jeff Bezos is just a kind of mastermind of efficiency, and so it's something that I think that, you know, we've had several conversations about when do gains to consumers kind of on the margin, you know, the next product that costs 10 cents less across the economy, but, you know, we lose a couple jobs. When do we kind of look at that balance sheet and say that's the creative process of the market, creative destruction? And, you know, President Trump doesn't seem to get that. And so I think this is going to fizzle out just because I don't see where the kind of realized gain is from it. I don't think that President Trump's base, I mean, they tend to get fired up about anything that President Trump gets fired up about. So we'll see. But I don't think this is a real core issue for them, and it's probably going to fizzle out just like all of the other feeds do.
See, I imagine, I mean, judging by your analysis, you seem to be a big fan of Amazon.
Oh, I love Amazon. I would give Amazon as much data as they wanted from my personal accounts.
See, I have mixed feelings about this. So on the one hand, it is true that the USPS does give a huge subsidy to Amazon, but that has to do with, you know, leverage, and Amazon is a huge, you know, they could, I mean, the USPS could arguably get more out of Amazon if they applied more leverage on Amazon. But let's be clear, the USPS is the way that the whole regulatory thing works is that they go through a postal regulatory commission, which is run by the Republicans. Okay. And then in the past, the Republican Congresses have defunded the USPS. And in fact, Donald Trump, in a savings program, wanted to cut the retirement benefits and other benefits for USPS workers. So the idea that he cares about the USPS is spurious, okay? I mean, this is the classic Republican thing of you defund the government office, and then you complain about it, and then you try to privatize it, which is what he wants to do. And so with regards to Amazon, I think this is all talk, and like you said, I do think this is all talk and no action. Because if you see what he's done in practice with what Amazon has been allowed to do, it's just crazy. I mean, first off, like when you look at the FTC, right? Mm-hmm. The FTC last year could have tried to do something with regards to Amazon buying up Whole Foods, and there were antitrust alarms being rung about Amazon buying Whole Foods, but the FTC approved that with little to no questions asked. Then you look at the tax bill that they passed recently, right? It literally gives them like a $789 million windfall, and Amazon paid zero in federal tax in 2017, and they're probably going to pay, you know, zero, probably less than zero in 2018, because they're going to get subsidies in federal tax, right? And then you look at Amazon on the state level. You know, Amazon has been running this sort of reality TV show with where it's going to put its next headquarters. And you have, I talked about this last show, where these cities, including Austin, are bending over backwards to try to get Amazon to come in by giving them tax incentives and subsidies and whatever. So, yeah, Amazon has been given this sort of, you know, in terms of how it's been operating. Yeah, it's like this rogue state, really, because it's been able to, like, you know, get so, you know, it's been able to get so much out of these state and federal governments. I mean, it's crazy. But yes, I think that, you know, I do think that if he actually did want to go after Amazon, not just because of politics, but because it would actually help the country in terms of getting taxes out of them, that would be a good idea. But I don't think he's going to do it, because I mean, it's unlikely that he will, because if you look at his past record, he's just allowed Amazon to do whatever it wants. And again, Amazon, I think, is also moving towards drones and stuff like that. So I don't think in the long term they're going to continue using the postal service. So I don't know what this line of attack is going to do. And I frankly, I don't even understand the market shock against this. I don't know why they got so afraid of him just saying this against Amazon. It's not like, you know, he has acted on, I don't think he is going to act on it. I mean, he has been acting on the tariffs sort of thing with China regarding IP. But with Amazon, which is a company, you know, based in the United States, that's a different story, I think.
Yeah, well, this is actually a pattern that we've seen. I remember a Planet Money podcast, I don't know if you listened to them, a while back, that created a bot that would kind of comb Trump's Twitter and make trades based on which companies he was attacking. So the pattern, if you will, is that he attacks a company. There's a kind of market fear of regulation and a market fear of blowback, and so that drives stock down. And then, but it's an artificial fear, you know, it never actually materializes into anything. And so the stock climbs back up. And so what Planet Money did is, like, you know, they've got this thing that buys low when Trump attacks, and then sells it back. I mean, it's something that I think he bloviates about, and something that I don't think, you know, he really has the legislative or the kind of attention span will to follow through on.
Yeah.
And to your point about leveraging Amazon for tax money, I don't see that playing out for Donald Trump. You know, these companies...
Yeah, I don't see it either. But I do think that, you know, I wish he would try to do something with regards to getting money out of these companies. I mean, these they've been paying zero in taxes, and many of them go offshore. And, like, there's no... You know, it's millions and millions of dollars of government revenue that's just sitting there, and that's not being taken in, right? And I wish he would go after them.
Yeah, I'm not terribly well versed on the kind of tax policy regarding Amazon. You know, one thing that we did see in the 2017 tax plan was the repatriation issue got settled. And so when and if Amazon decides to bring that money back into the U.S. for investments,
I don't know why they would. I mean,
they would be taxed on that in theory. And so, yeah, I you know, coming from the kind of pro-market, pro-business side of things, I think Amazon really has been a net boon to consumers. And in terms of regulation, I'm rather wary of any kind of policies that would aim to restrict them arbitrarily or artificially compared to other businesses.
I don't think that's arbitrary to say that Amazon, like other vendors in America, should be able to pay federal tax.
Oh no, I completely agree with you on that. You know,
I mean, they're skirting the laws. This is from a law and order perspective, which is what the Trump always talks about, law and order. These companies are just not caring about law and order.
I mean, the analysis that I've seen is that Amazon has really just taken advantage of existing tax law loops. So skirting the spirit of law, sure, if you will. But that's the problem with these incredibly complex tax codes and the incredibly kind of complex system of taxes and how it favors big business. You know, it is mind blowing the fact that Amazon paid no federal income tax. That, you know, makes no sense. But when you look at the ability that they have to use incredibly, you know, sophisticated algorithms and legal teams to game the system, if you will, it's not all that surprising. And it's something that, you know, already they have the competitive advantage in terms of how they're able to use technology and use kind of economies of scale to outcompete retail. And so that, you know, is the process of the market and is totally fine. But in terms of how they're able to use just political clout and kind of legal maneuvering to get around that is something that I think we need to address. Mm-hmm. And it's just a kind of constant reminder of where we need to be looking for or looking towards in the tax system, something that treats those companies as businesses and on scale, on par with other businesses, and so doesn't create that kind of artificial winners and losers that we look at.
See, I think, I mean, when you talk about under the current system, I think the system is choosing winners and losers with Amazon and, you know, these big wig companies being the winners and the smaller companies being the losers. But I think that when you look at fundamentally, I think this comes back to what government ought to be. And I think government should be trying to make the, you know, marketplace a bit fairer, and does have to sometimes be so-called anti-business. It has to stand in opposition to a lot of these business actions. So, for example, with Amazon trying to get their HQ too, right, their second headquarters, they have been able to undermine so much local sovereignty. I mean, I know that in Cupertino, which is where I'm from, which is the Apple headquarters, Apple has so much political clout there that they're able to just wield it, and then, you know, it undermines the voters' interests in Cupertino. And then, you know, I don't know if when we're talking about the boon to the economy, right, like, yes, you know, it does help, you know, bringing jobs and stuff like that. But we have to ask at what price that is. I mean, when you have voters saying we don't want subsidies going to Amazon or Apple or something like that, and then it just gets passed anyways because Apple owns the city council or whatever, or Apple is just entrenched within the federal government. Same with Amazon. I mean, Amazon is entrenched within the federal government, and uses the federal government for a lot of their procurement tactics. I mean, when you talk about the buyer of last resort, the government is always considered the buyer of last resort. I mean, it gives subsidies to Amazon and Tesla and all these tech companies and doesn't get anything out of it. I mean, it does get something out of it, but like in terms of tax money, it doesn't get anything out of it. And if you want to talk about like the government as an entity, you know, if it's subsidizing all these companies that are just going around and, you know, not paying any taxes and tearing up local and, you know, state governments, I don't know what, you know, we should go after. I think we should go after them. And I don't think it is unfair to say that you should be treated the same as other companies that are trying to get into this marketplace, because there is something to be said about, you know, monopolies. And I think when you look at the tech companies, there's something to be said about like how much stuff they have and how much of the market that they're owning. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, people who care about, you know, fair competition in the marketplace should also think about, you know, monopolies and how monopolies can form and develop.
Yeah, and I think one thing that we kind of look at, and this is kind of steeped in the kind of free market monopoly literature that I've read, the idea that monopolies are bad when they become inefficient. You know, as long as they're benefiting the consumer, as long as they're driving down prices, the government tends.
But they won't. Why would they drive down
right,
prices?
Right. No. The incentive is not there. But yeah, currently, I don't think that the marketplace is conducive to Amazon, you know, running inefficiently or kind of trying to manipulate prices in that sense. You know, I think one thing that they're really at risk from is the kind of Uber economy, the idea that people, you know, one thing that is becoming increasingly popular is the secondhand exchange of durable goods that previously wasn't there. And so, you know, Poshmark is the kind of flagship program. I know it kind of sounds silly to talk about the clothing company as a threat to Amazon, but the exchange of secondhand durable goods is something that I think really is going to change the economy. Your assets that we typically had not thought of as part of your wealth. So the kind of smaller daily items that you use are going to be now marketable. And so that's going to be something that I don't think that they can just kind of sit on their heels and be mm-hmm. kind of revel in their monopoly. But you're not, I completely agree with the kind of sentiment of your argument there, the main thrust of it, the idea of treating these people as the same as other companies. And, you know, it's difficult because government has supplanted private interest as the representation in municipalities, and so there is no real clout that kind of cohesive business interest can yield that is superior to municipal government. So, you know, yes, we don't want these government or these municipalities subsidizing Amazon's business or Apple, what have you, but they have kind of pushed out private interests such that there is really no other option, and the kind of race to the bottom in terms of municipal subsidies is really, I mean, it's a boon to whoever gets it. You know, the HQ2 is going to be a true driver of economic growth in whichever city, you know, fingers crossed, Austin, it gets the HQ. And so yeah, it's difficult, you know, it kind of ruffles my feathers to see governments, you know, even municipal governments, state governments, handing out these subsidies to businesses that otherwise should compete fairly in the marketplace. Yeah. But for lack of a better interest group, it is something that, you know, is good for the municipalities, but bad for the kind of theory and integrity of government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess we'll have to end that conversation, because I do want to move to the VA Secretary David Shulkin. I mean, he has been sort of in relative obscurity for a little while. He was approved And then he, I think there was a lot of controversy about him going to Europe, and for example, on the taxpayer dime.
Yeah, there. So he took an official trip to Europe, which, you know, is well within their right to do. But he took his wife and accepted Wimbledon tickets. Was the kind of big controversy, and so, you know, they did some sightseeing on the taxpayer dime, and so that riled. I kind of put that on the second order of kind of causal factors in this.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that if you look at what Shulkin said, he said that he was kicked out because of the whole thing about the privatization, which is what Trump has been pushing for, the privatizing the VA. And now you see his pick for the VA secretary, who happens to be his physician. He's a doctor. Another example of just Trump just pointing at someone in the room saying, you're going to be the guy who runs things. You know, it's, I don't know. I mean, he's the doctor now. And now I think he also wants his pilot to run the Federal Aviation Agency. Just more examples of the incompetence of this guy running the government. He's just pointing at random people. But anyways, it just...
I mean, there's two factors to that. One is... the market pool for people who want to be in an administration that undercuts its cabinet level members at basically every turn is shrinking and ever shrinking. And and so the physician that Trump has, you know, is not, unfortunately, I think, to the kind of mass chagrin of everybody who's hoping it was the kind of Gandalf, portly, Santa looking fella that declared Trump the healthiest man to ever be president.
Yeah, I remember that guy.
So it's not him. It's the kind of White House official musician. It's not musician, sorry, physician.
I'm glad that it isn't that guy, because that guy clearly is not of sound mind.
Yeah, so, you know, he has a kind of...
it looks like something's wrong with it.
What's
something going on?
I'm going to check the mic.
Okay, yeah, so Ronnie Jackson is the guy's name. He is this kind of guy who comes from a military background and serves as Trump's personal physician.
Yeah, we're right.
And, you know, did so for President Obama as well, and I think he began his tenure in the Bush administration.
I think I see the issue.
We have some people in here.
Yeah, sorry guys, we're dealing with a little bit of technical stuff. He kind of has a background. He served in Afghanistan as an emergency physician, and, you know, he does not have the administrative background that we would look for.
Of course not.
In a VA secretary. But, you know, Shulkin was in a difficult position. The VA as a single payer or quasi single payer system is inherently difficult to run. It's got both the inefficiencies of single payer and the inefficiencies of government, and it's got them in spades.
I would disagree. I mean, if you look at the care that the VA provides, it's one of the best in the country. I mean, 93% of veterans who use the VA like it, despite the wait times. But in terms of quality care, I mean, it's some of the best in the country.
The kind of counterpoint to that is that somewhere on the order of half of the veterans that are eligible for the VA don't use it because it provides such long wait times and inefficient care. It's something
I think the problem with the VA has to do with access and not care. There's a difference there. Access has to do with the wait times, et cetera. Care is the quality of care, I think, it's pretty uncontroversial among experts that the care is very good. The problem is the access. And the wait times is an issue. But I do think, I mean, when you talk about single payer, I think this is a good starting point to talk about the single payer healthcare system. But you were saying?
Yeah, and so the kind of pricing structures that exist in the private healthcare field don't exist in the VA, and so running it is a difficult task. These people are not compensated particularly well on terms of the employee side, and that is a rather difficult process. I think I remember probably one of my first political memories was the VA debacle. that, you know, had people dying on their waiting list, and the, you know, ensuing cover-up that occurred. And so, yeah, it's just something that...
I mean, one has to ask, for example, the I think if you look at the VA, it consistently outperforms, and Medicare and all these sort of government, so-called, I mean, Medicare is not single payer as so much as VA, which runs the hospitals, but, you know, they consistently outperform the private sector healthcare plans, and one has to ask, how many scandals are there in private insurance markets where people just die because they can't afford the, you know, the money, they can't afford the healthcare. I mean, it's... I think in terms of the wait times, I mean, the reason the VA is so terrible, let's remember that the VA was one of the ones that pioneered the whole concept of the wait time, like it, and the metric for wait times. So I just think that when people talk about, and it's pretty uncontroversial also, that the U.S. healthcare system, which is more privatized than the other developed countries, is the worst in the developed nations. And, I mean, that's not lost on the American people. The American people want Medicare for all. They want kind of positions like the VA. They look at the VA, they look at Medicare, and they say, hey, why can't I get that sort of coverage? And I think a lot of the, you know, the libertarian sort of criticisms of the single-payer healthcare system really fall flat when you look at the empirical data.
Yeah, and, you know, I unfortunately did not bring my armament of statistics and stuff on healthcare. I was a bit more well-versed in it. When I was, you know, kind of senior in high school, and I actually am kind of one of the few libertarians that really does field the idea of single payer healthcare seriously, in terms of how it can be implemented efficiently and how it can be done. And it's something that, you know, in the VA, we've got a real moral culpability to provide for these people.
That's very true as well.
These are folks that, you know, the combat kind of sector of the military is not particularly large, not a significant number of people participating in combat in terms of how many people are actually in the military. But they did our nation a great service, and we do kind of have the moral culpability to provide them healthcare. And so it is a travesty that at both ends we try to provide this healthcare service and then undercut it with inefficient, you know, people, inefficient management, and people who don't have the requisite experience, which is something that we're seeing with Trump's. And you know, look, the guy hasn't started. So the jury's a bit out, but this is a system that has something on the order of 350,000 employees, and this guy has managed at the largest, perhaps a couple dozen of people. And so this is not something that you take lightly. These are people with serious health issues and people that have incurred these health problems in the field of service. And so I, of course, would prefer, you know, as I've described in the past, I'm of the kind of position, if it's there, run it efficiently.
Yeah.
And so this does not seem to be a step in that direction.
Well, I think, again, like I mentioned before, it's another part of, you know, during the Obama years, the leading Veterans Affairs organization that came forward, which is supposed to be representing the veterans, was in awe when they had the budgets for, I mean, they were increasing funding to the VA, but the VA people were saying that the VA, the veterans, like administration and the groups affiliated with the veterans are saying, we need more money because the claims are soaring here after Iraq and all these wars, right? And so they, I mean, in terms of what they wanted, they didn't really get what they wanted. And so I think this is another example of how we have this general trend of what people do is they defund the public organization. They'll defund it, and then after a few years, they'll say, look at how terrible it is. Look at how poorly managed it is. Let's privatize it. You see the same thing with infrastructure. They defund infrastructure plans, then the bridges start collapsing, and then they say, hey, look, we have to privatize it to make it better. And it, I mean, the same thing happened with the UK waterways recently, like they defunded the water systems, and they started going badly, and they say privatize it. And so I think we have to really look at the funding issue. And there are a lot of things that, I mean, the VA in the 1990s really underwent a dramatic shift in terms of efficiency, and that really helped it outperform a lot of the private insurance plans. And I do think that we have to look at that. And you look at the Shulkin term. I mean, I'm not going to miss David Shulkin, because if you look at what he did with regards to veterans, I mean, he was not, for example, I think he and Ben Carson were working on this plan to cut benefits to homeless veterans. They were trying to get, like, there was a program to get homeless veterans, you know, homes, and they were going to cut that. And then there was a huge outcry, and so they said, okay, we're going to walk that back. And then you look at what Trump is doing right now with the plans to, he wants to cut Social Security benefits for these people who are disabilities. Mm. Many veterans have disabilities, you know. There's a program to retrain veterans that they're trying to cut. So, I mean, when you talk about people who desperately need healthcare, I mean, there's a lot of people in the United States that really do need it. And I think that the moral obligation to help people who are, you know, in the richest country in the world dying is immense. But then when you think about the veterans who went to these countries, you know, in the corners of the Middle East for ostensibly American interests, and then they come back and they're homeless. It's just crazy how we're treating them.
Yeah. And something that I think we both agree on is that moral culpability as it relates to veterans and their health interest. One kind of interesting study I'd like to mention is the one coming out of the Cato Institute, which, you know, is that kind of libertarian think tank that so many people love to pan, but does occasionally hold a popular opinion. And what they're talking about is pinning the healthcare cost of veterans, or the predicted healthcare cost of a war, to the actual cost. So they would, you know, pin the price of claims that they could predict from a war to the actual cost of the war itself.
And so, I think that's a very good idea.
Yeah, and so
thinking about the fallout of the war.
Right, it would increase the cost of going to war and therefore also kind of provide that healthcare funding for veterans when they do come home. And so it's both a war deterrent, and it fulfills our moral culpability to those veterans. And just kind of one of the many ways that I think we can exemplify, you know, how the government, you know, responsibility in national defense is both one of protecting American interest and doing that, you know, judiciously, but also the national defense in terms of protecting those who protect our country. And so, you know, these folks are kind of they're immensely maltreated by the system, in my view. There are real injustices done in the VA system, and something that, you know, we just got new increased Pentagon defense spending, and yet the VA you know, still does not have the funding required. I think it's just a complete shame.
One thing I did want to mention is that, you know, right before we end, is that if you look at the approval rating of Donald Trump right now, it stands at 42%, which is actually very high given
relative
his history.
Relative to
his history. And, you know, we talk about the incompetence in this government, and it's just remarkable that people are still not getting it through. And I think one of the reasons is because of the study that came out recently that showed that we're increasingly, people are looking at polarization, and it's more of a matter of my team is winning versus the policies are good. And there was a study that was just released that showed that on both sides, Republicans and Democrats. And I think it's important to have cooler heads prevail. I mean, I think we're leading to increased polarization. That's having a lot on a lot of sides. We're dividing, you know, in terms of, and I think people need to step in, you know, responsible media organizations like the Texas Orator, for one. but I think that, you know, it's important that we keep trying to be coming from a data-driven perspective, because a lot of politics is just opinions, and everyone can have an opinion about politics, but it's a matter of fact. And I think a lot of these things we've been discussing today, it's a matter of facts and not opinions.
Yeah, and one thing that I think is interesting, and kind of I'll segue to some stuff that I'm thinking about, is the kind of social benefits of holding popular opinions outweighing the kind of benefits that we would tend to get from holding truth-based opinions. And so in politics, you know, you get one vote for kind of the presidency, you get one vote every 6 years for your kind of congressman. So you don't get all that many opportunities to actually participate in the you know, electoral system, and then those votes are kind of statistically insignificant. And so one thing that I'm looking at is the actual gains to individuals from holding the popular belief of those around them and the kind of social gains, and why it's not irrational to hold gains that you, or hold, you know, opinions that, you know, contradict the facts but are similar to those around you in terms of just the purely self-interested voter, and why that presents a kind of active danger to democracy and democratic discourse.
Yeah, well, I'll be interested in seeing how that turns out. I hope everyone has a good week, and we're gonna have to end it there because it's time. So
all righty.